this prelude to the discussion. This is not an effort to jump on a bandwagon about some kind of a controversial issue. Obviously it is a highly volatile and emotional issue for a good number of people. But in contrast to 10 years ago, 5 years ago, perhaps maybe even a couple of years ago, many more people are aware of people in their acquaintanceship, indeed maybe in their own family, where there is someone who is homosexual. By the way, you can use any word you want tonight, homosexual, gay, whichever word you want to use. I'm not going to be fussy. I hope nobody else is going to be fussy how you refer, what word you use. I hope you're comfortable about that. But there are, through many of the events around us, certainly Anita Bryant's activities, certainly the feminist movement, which by some people has been labeled as part of a move towards lesbianism, towards the whole openness about people who are homosexual. And just this week again, Seattle, a decision to have a referendum about the law on discrimination against homosexuals. So it's an issue right around us. They estimate that some, varies, 5 to 10% of the population are, quote, committed homosexuals. If that would be true, that means in a congregation of 300, that's about how many people, 15 people in a parish that you can expect, or 30 or whatever it is, 5% would be about 15 people in a parish, that they would be around us. What's the human, the Christian, the pastoral, if you will, concern for these people? Should the church accept homosexuals? That's the subject before us. Anyone's willing to speak? Surely are invited to.
For me, the thing hinges on the word accept.
Oh, excuse me, okay.
For one thing. And
do you want to say what that means to you, or does that help?
You don't have to.
Do you want to say what accept means to you, or do you?
Yeah, well, maybe I'll do that.
Okay.
Because if you come to the point, say, that homosexual activity is sinful, then if you say, well, if you accept the sinful activity, then you're not really doing the admonishment brother to brother we need to be doing, no matter how difficult that is to do.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say in the church, we accept someone within our fellowship who has homosexual tendencies or choices, that's saying one thing.
Mm-hmm.
If they are repentant toward what we consider to be sinful, and we're trying to support them with their problem, then I think we have no choice but to. But if you mean by accept, to accept them with that as a condition, then I think that's where the church really has to address itself to what Scripture says. And so that, I guess to me, when I say accept in the church, I would say, because I guess at my point of view, I view that as a problem of sin, that it has to be someone for me in order to accept him and embrace him in the fellowship that shares that and is trying to work with that problem, just like I would be with, say, heterosexual activities. As far as sex acts, that would be my problem, you know, to control.
Has the point been raised, or the question been raised, of what homosexuals in terms of what? Do we find out whether they have intimate sexual relations and are homosexual, or if they do not have those but they are homosexual? That's all right. Is that question been raised?
No, it hasn't. Do you think that's important?
I don't know that it's important, but I think it's the point at which most people react to someone as being homosexual, or whether they have sexual relations that are homosexual.
I see.
And that homosexual relationships happen all the time, I would hope, between people of the same sex, in terms of what you were talking about the other day, mm-hmm. as far as that sexuality goes. And I mean, I don't think I've ever asked anybody in my life if they're heterosexual. So why should I care if anybody is homosexual?
They can't hear you.
So churches were at one time or other speaking about, should we accept minorities? And now I think the question is, how do we attract minorities? I served on a committee for the Commission on the Clergy and Lay on Human Sexuality. And I think there were two of us straight women, and I wasn't too sure about the other women. Anyway, I found there was much love and concern expressed among the homosexuals and the lesbians and the men and homosexuals and the gays as they were referring to themselves. And they weren't exactly breaking down the doors to come into our churches. They didn't feel accepted. They didn't feel welcomed. And so they turned into my area to the Metropolitan Community Church, which was founded by a gay pastor. And didn't last too long in Oakland because it was meeting in a distressed bench bunny in a salon, a hair dressing salon, which they said was probably the proper milieu, most people might think. But anyway, I don't think that we're thinking of ourselves as Christian and being open to all people. I think the church should be. Our churches are not open, and we are looking at someone who is different. We look at people who are different, and they come from another class, another race. Oftentimes, I think our middle-class white churches do that, and we certainly look and give that type of feeling to the gay community who might venture into our church by mistake and find out quickly that they weren't comfortable, or they made us look uncomfortable.
Yes, sir.
About 40 years ago, I think one of the problems the church faced was, well, the congregation I was in, was whether divorced people could be a member of the church. And there were great controversies raging over this. And I think this is and they were using Paul and Romans as the real basis for their discussions then. And I think we're doing the same thing now. And the whole idea, really, the scripture is to accept people as they are and to help them where they are, not necessarily to make them like society wants them or our society today, but as God would have. And this is a personal judgment on each person's part.
One kind of switch for me came when I guess my assumption that people were homosexual, that they could be either homosexual or heterosexual, and then they made a choice to be homosexual. And in the very limited contact that I get, there wasn't a choice for the individual. That young man was simply homosexual. There was no heterosexual option for him.
People that tend to distinguish between homosexual attraction, which may just happen, it would be appealing, and that normally includes erotic in this context, erotic sexual, and not simply my relationship to my father, which of course would be homosexual relationship too, in the sense that we're of the same sex, but that it would be a difference between attraction and then a difference between behavior, which would include activity, or whether it is an orientation in which, as you were talking about, some are considered it possible, obviously, to be bisexual, homosexual, and heterosexual, or what is called not perversion, but inversion, which is a commitment towards homosexual activity as a lifestyle and a repulsion of heterosexual activity. Yes, sir, just for definitions, you can use them as you will.
You want the
rest? No, you stopped. You read the all
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, I read it. I just reread the first part.
Well, but we'll read the second part again.
Oh, okay, I'll read the whole thing. If a man also lieth with mankind, as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination, they shall surely be put to death.
Okay, that's the part I wanted to hear. So that would be okay.
Right.
The abomination is associated with being put to death. It's serious enough to be put to death. So if you would it be accurate to say that if you accept that it's abomination, you ought also accept that its punishment is death. Is that correct? Or would you select part of the verse?
Well, if you read, it's the same thing. As far as I'm concerned, Leviticus is a bunch of rules, as she said. Mm-hmm. In the same if not in the same chapter, at least in the chapter or so before.
18.
There mm-hmm. are some other rules that are right. laid down that are quite punishable by some drastic means, mm-hmm. like mending a garment with another kind of right. cloth, mm-hmm. or putting or planting in the same field with two kinds of seeds.
Or
all of these things are sure. not to be done and punishable in some way or another.
Or intercourse during menstrual cycle
yeah.
is mentioned also.
There are all kinds of those. So if you're going to accept one verse, then maybe you ought to accept all of Leviticus. I mean, this is the thing that you need to interpret what Leviticus says in the light for which it was intended.
Or to say it maybe another way is that's not very easy to get clear about, at least at the moment, because we're not asking everybody just to buy it, but if you read that passage, you really have to read it all, as you did, you know, and deal with it all. And that's the struggle that I feel many people are in, as was mentioned up there and all around. Those passages are very difficult. I don't know if you really got your answer, John, sir, when you ask what does the Bible say. It does. There are places, references. The Leviticus passages are most serious. The Romans passage, 1 Corinthians and 1 Timothy also speak about it. Those are serious passages, and most people today who are concerning themselves about this are spending time trying to uncover what is the meaning of these passages. Those who start from the basis, as you do, and I would understand most Lutherans do, to say, well, what does the word say to this? So I want to dodge. I knew that, but I would rather that other people would be sharing. And now we have two of them out, and there are others, and maybe others would feel there are more than that.
You were talking yesterday about sexuality. You were one of
yes, sir.
And you made a reference to the Old Testament. I think you were reference to that.
That's
specific.
Right. That's
Could
right.
But
one of the understandings of that passage, the Leviticus passage, is that, and the reason for the drastic punishment for that, is that homosexuality was connected with Canaanitic worship ritual. That in order to perform this was to symbolize an acceptance of the Canaanitic worship and would be an imitation of it. And so that it was viewed as a step against idolatry rather than a step against, essentially, against homosexuality. The whole of the passage, for these people at least, is that the passage is dealing with how do you keep yourself from getting to the wrong God. One way is through homosexual activities, which in their culture meant you were somehow connected with a Canaanitic worship. And so the death thing was in punishment of idolatry and not about a physical act for these people who understand it that way. That's one point of view about those passages. That's, I think, what I shared yesterday. Sure.
I was going to add that we don't have a death penalty for idolatry anymore either.
That's right. That's right. Sure.
I'd like to ask Jenny the question concerning this illustration, the young man she referred to. She said, I heard you right, that he had no choice. Is this information or knowledge medical or theological or psychological or all combination of all three?
Yes.
I think what you're referring to is the Romans section, the whole of that section you meant before, which again, if you read it, deals largely with idolatry also. I don't mean exclusively, because I think that's a very difficult passage. To where it says, because of that idolatry, God has given them up to. And it seems, you know, the connection between idolatry and punishment. The punishment was homosexuality. But I don't know that the other was there. That's one way, again, of reading that passage. There may be others. But I think that's where your reference would come from if you read that Romans passage. Now, others may know. I jumped in fast with an answer. Respecting your point of view, would you be willing to talk with someone who is homosexual about whether that's what God meant? In other words, your understanding, which is indeed held by many people, assumes that God's intent was only heterosexual relationships. Would you be willing to discuss with somebody that issue? Say, for perhaps a homosexual person.
I've never had a chance to go and tell the truth. I think it's the same like anybody else that's lost. I believe it's more than being lost.
Yeah. Right. I guess what I'm trying to say, are you willing to meet with somebody that without that presupposition yet to discuss whether or not they're lost and then take an action?
Yeah.
See, the presupposition makes it very difficult to talk to that person.
Well, I've never had a chance.
Yeah, all right.
I guess I would be a little prejudiced now.
Okay. I don't mean to say in any sense of your being wrong, but I mean a willingness to hear that other point of view, which, as you would know, would be different. Someone else.
I think the key is still the question that you ask, what is sin?
Okay.
Because we're talking as if. Let's just say, okay, it's a sin. So is Reed, so is Jonathan, so is, let's take all of that sins that we have. So the homosexual is more condemned than we are then. Is there a greater sin and a lesser sin? Or are they all condemned in the sight of God? If we're going to talk in terms of morality and acts, then we have to face the fact that we all then should not be in the church, because I am jealous sometimes. I am greedy. That sin is no different than homosexuality in God's sight. I faced that when someone I knew very well had a child out of wedlock. She couldn't hide her sin. We do a very good job. We pretend we aren't sinful. In that sense. So I think we have to go back to, okay, what is sin? Is it a broken relationship with God? Or is it, is it doing things? I thought that was one of the things, that hating was just as bad as murder, if we're going to talk that way. I think we really have to face that issue.
Okay.
Assuming for the moment that homosexuality is a sin, to use the illustration that the young lady had at work with, I do not celebrate my jealousy or my lust or my hatred. I wrestle with these. And there are those in the homosexual community who wish to celebrate this. I think it's part of the problem that we wrestle with.
But there are in our society those who celebrate lust, certainly.
Oh, and we have a difficult job giving up our sin.
Sure.
I think you are repentant of them.
Okay.
Well, that's no excuse.
Are they welcome in the church?
Yeah. Are we welcome when we, we pretend we're not greedy, but boy, our friends know it. Are we still welcomed and they admonish us, not accuse us. They try to work with us, maybe in love, in care, or do they reject us? Well, we do get rejected, too.
I'm very much in favor of continuing this discussion, but I'd like to bring us back to the other point, is that the gay people will not accept that point of view. They will not accept being gay as being part of sin. That's one of our difficulties. Now, we can talk about it as a, quote, straight community, and I put that in quotes for sure. But so we have to come back to the other two, but let's stick with this one. Please, Ernie.
The other night you had a forum here on what do you expect from a pastor, and I sat in this forum, and I didn't open up my big mouth once. In fact, I was so happy that I retired from the ministry that I almost went home and had two hallelujahs and four. So I came here tonight to open my big mouth, and I'll tell you a story. This stuff is nothing new. How many are acquainted with Sodom and Gomorrah? How many know the story intimately? We get the word sodomy from that. And it's as old as that. That goes back all the way to Lot, the nephew of Abraham, 4,000 years ago in our recorded history and Bible. At the seminary, when I went to seminary, that was a long time ago,
They never taught us anything about this. In fact, in our bull sessions, we were just in, like, way in the stratosphere. We didn't even know what we were talking about. Well, in World War II, crossing the North Atlantic in a convoy with all kinds of corvettes and submarine chasers going around, our battalion doctor was talking with me in the rail of a ship, and he says, "Chaplain, if you ever bumped into a homosexual, go to bat for him." I said, "What for?" And he says, "He'll get a DD, a dishonorable discharge. You'll even go to the pen." Because that's just like having a heterosex guy turned loose in a girl's dormitory. Well, we got to a place called Bietigheim am Rhein in Germany. One night, a young soldier, he was 19 years old, the youngest kid in our battalion, came to me with a crumbled piece of paper in his hand, and he threw it to me, and I opened it up, and it was a suicide note. He was a confessed homosexual, and he was going through a veritable hell in the sex-starved company where he was quartered. And you people have no idea what war is. Not the casualties in the battlefield, but the moral casualties that go on every day of the week. And so we called him Colonel, a brilliant chap. I liked him. And he sat most of the night with me. But I promised him I'd take him to Mainz, the general hospital, and see if I could get him a medical discharge, which ultimately I was able to do the next day. But I questioned him quite a bit. And after he realized that I had confidence in him, he asked me this question. That was a big one. He says, "Chaplain, when I get out, and if I get out and am free, may I have a friend?" You know what he meant. Mm-hmm. Brother, that was a question to be thrown at a dumb Lutheran chaplain. So I thought quite a while. And this is my response. I don't know if I answered correctly or not. You judge that. I said, "Colonel, I know a lot of old maids. I know a lot of bachelors who are heterosex. And they're playing the game straight. Not doing their thing. And if the gay boys want to do that, well then why can't all of the unmarried people do that? But they're playing the game straight." Amen.
Thanks, Ernie. Yeah. Someone else, please.
To get back to the question of sin, it's not, I think it's more than, there's more than just a historical connection with idolatry and Canaanite idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a theological connection that we as Lutherans ought to be aware of, and that is Luther's contention that all of sin basically is sin against the first commandment. That all sin, the mark of all sin, is the extent to which a particular act is symptomatic of idolatry. And isn't the question then that always needs to be asked of any particular action, is this an action that is an action of self-worship that exalts the creature over the creator, or is it an act of love? I think that's the question that needs to be asked of homosexual actions as of every other human action that's conceivable. And it's not at all inconceivable to me that love between two people of the same sex can be real and as deep, as fulfilling, as creative as other sorts of actions. It's not to say there aren't problems connected with it, there aren't shortcomings. Laws of probability as to the lastingness of particular relations may not be as solid and all the rest. But I think when we ask the question of sin, we need to be aware of the extent to which a particular action is idolatrous.
Thank you. Others want to respond to that? Please, any?
We're talking about sin. We're talking about bad. But I think that one of the greatest gifts that God gave us is love. And I believe that love through any man to any man or any woman to any woman is being able to use the gifts that God gave us. And if that's the way that a person chooses to use them, at least he's using those gifts.
If we accept homosexuality as that love makes an effect, should we put out the same restrictions you put on heterosexual love? Like, you know, it's not, you shouldn't do it like before you're married or whatever like that. You should only have like intercourse with one person, and if outside of that it's adulterous and stuff like that. I mean, should we put the same bounds on it and subject it to the same treatment? Or should we still keep it separate?
Someone have a response?
I think those who engage in homosexual love to have enough crap dumped on them without also applying the kind of crap that we pay on heterosexual love.
But if they want to say it's as natural as heterosexual love, shouldn't they be subjected to the same thing?
But I'm not sure.
A little louder, Duffy. I'm not sure we all can hear you.
My remark is just that maybe it's off base. I guess. I don't think it was an expression. I don't understand where that question is coming from. Maybe that's what is confusing me. If we have problems with men accepting homosexual love and homosexual activity as valid, then, you know, why make it more complicated by trying to hang a lot of garbage on homosexual activities, such as, you know, doing it before you're married might be kind of hard in this country society. But, you know, I think the whole issue of getting it goes into leaving is just homosexuality.
Indeed.
We have to look at our sexuality.
The relationship of the whole discussion to the issue that is made here, which leads us in to human relationships, to sexuality, or human sexuality. That's why the new Roman Catholic book that has come out, I think, does a good job, at least, of putting it in that context. That it's a great big warning. There's 32 pages about homosexuality, and it says, boy, if you read this section without reading the rest, you're really a dope and you're dishonest and everything else, because it really belongs in the whole context of what is human relationships and value. I thought they did some good jobs in setting up some initial, and they said it tentatively, values to be looked at when you look at whether it's a heterosexual or homosexual relationship. In that sense, they do put it together, what they're saying. And their values are self-liberating, the activity is self-liberating, is other-enriching, is honest, is faithful, is socially responsible, is life-serving, and is joyous. Now, that's more help than most of us got in establishing heterosexual relationships, it seems to me. At least we didn't talk that much about it. I'm not asking anybody, again, to buy in automatically here, but to say whatever the relationship is going to be ought to have some bases, and for us, come out of a Christian understanding what it means to relate to another person, which on its other side means what is the Christian way, I mean, what a Christian understanding of what it means to be destructive to another person that we call sin. Go ahead.
I guess, you know, I react to, I didn't see what I was speaking there, but as far as the things, the one word really hit me was subject. I don't think God or we subject biblical warnings and admonishments as far as proper behavior. I think those are really gifts to use what God has given us in a proper way. And the biggest problem in all that, and that ties into the whole concept of sin, mm-hmm. is our perspective on what it is. And you know, the thing you just read there is helpful. I really like that in that direction. Because what so often happens, no matter what the relationship is, we're messing things up very badly. And like earlier someone mentioned, like how divorce, the view for divorce has changed in the last 40 years. I don't think that's good. And I don't think we should hold it up and say, gee, look at this, we've got away with this, we've changed it. I think the church has to really say, you know, there is real sin when that relationship is broken, and we need to spend a lot more time keeping those relationships growing and teaching people how to do that, rather than take the easy way out and just accept people when they, you know, because of their perspective, haven't done it. And I think there's a huge job to reorientate ourselves back to the concept of Christian love, of giving instead of the taking position, of servanthood, of care, of concern, and develop all those relationships beyond our natural drives, which are very powerful and very beautiful and gifts, but can be misused oh so easily.
Well then,
I'm frustrated when I can't express myself sexually to a woman, but that doesn't mean that God's subjecting me to anything. He's saying, before you do that, make sure you know a lot of other things.
But you talk about it as a giving thing, and I think it's very possible for a homosexual experience to be a giving thing. A man I know who's a drug addict had a good friend, and they were both high and on heroin, and his friend started crying and was just terribly, terribly upset and very, very depressed. And man got his friend to trust him enough to explain what was wrong, and it turned out his friend was a closet homosexual and felt a lot of guilt over it, and really, really had a great desire to get involved with this man sexually. He was really hurting, and this man loved his friend enough that if his friend had asked him, he would have engaged in sexual activity with him. And to me, that's real giving. He loved his friend enough in his need.
I don't know if that's love when you do whatever somebody asks you to do.
Oh, come on. I just...
Oh, I respect your point of view, but I just don't agree with it.
Well, then what's love?
There was one answer back there. Go ahead. Please.
Love is seeking the good of the other, regardless of the cost. Who defines the good of the other, whether the person who is giving or the person who is on the receiving end? This is a big question.
I don't know. I guess I just find it real hard to sit in judgment on these people. I just can't stand in judgment on them at all. I don't feel called to.
Would you make a distinction between judgment and choice?
I can choose for myself.
That's
but
what I meant.
I can't judge other people. Yeah.
No, I meant for the man who is giving in that situation. I don't mean judging the homosexual. I meant making a choice of whether I would give or not. That's what I meant.
You mean if I was in that situation?
Well, or that fellow that gave was
yeah.
willing to give.
Yeah.
He had a choice. He wouldn't have to make a judgment. Is that a distinction? I happen to think it is.
I'm not sure I quite understand.
Well, maybe it isn't that important.
I think it might be, but I
well, you said the gentleman was, he really would have loved, he would have given himself to him and all that.
Mm-hmm.
He was making a choice at that
mm-hmm.
point. And I think we all have choices to make. And sometimes choices are viewed as judgments of other people. If I would not give to that person physically at that time, someone could have said, I judged you.
Oh.
But it may have been a choice
okay.
on my part.
Yeah, I think it would have been a choice. It was a choice
mm-hmm.
on his part.
And I think responsibility, my responsibility for my life in the Lord includes that possibility of my choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I heard Bertrand brought out a very beautiful point today, the difference between admonition and judgment. And I think we have to be clear on that. In admonition, we love the person for trying to help them. In judgment, we're way past that. And if the church accepts a person, they accept them in the sense of admonition and not condoning what they're doing and to work with them. But judgment means that you already decided before you've even heard the case.
No, that's prejudice.
Yes.
I've been thinking about a discussion that I had with gay people that I know 10 years ago, and then I thought of a recent discussion I had within the last couple of weeks. And I was trying to come up with answers just now as I was listening to her and to everybody. And every time I came up with an answer for the gay person, they have to affect right along. I was thinking of one of my friends who's gay, and he, every time I talk to him, Barb, I've got a new boyfriend, you know, he's really super. And there's someone different that he's trying to love. He's just, he needs this love. But on the other hand, I think of a friend of mine, a gal friend who's single, who's the same thing. So I used to think that I really knew where I stood, and now I'm so, you've got them both. You've got the heterosexual and the homosexual. They've all got needs, the single people, the divorced people that are in the church, the homosexuals that are in the closet that you may not know about, that are in the church.
Sure.
So it's just a whole...
Promiscuity is a facet of both, isn't it? But I know heterosexuals who are faithful. I know homosexuals who are faithful. I just want to label either one of those as being automatically promiscuous. Okay, and you weren't, but I was lifting it up a little more. Yes, sir.
When you say faithful, is that you're not using that to cover the area of continence?
No, faithful to one other person.
One other person.
Yes, sir.
And you can add the other.
Oh, yeah, continent too.
That's a lifestyle too.
Indeed it is.
Yeah.
Sure. Continence is a lifestyle.
I was talking with a nurse a member of our congregation, and when she moved to town to do some graduate study, one of the things that really frustrated her is that she and a friend of hers were going to live together, and they wanted a two-bedroom apartment to cut costs down and so on.
Yeah.
They had a terrible time renting an apartment because at every turn it was alleged that they were a couple of lesbians living together,
man.
And that therefore nobody was going to rent to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an interesting phenomenon, and we've carried the pendulum to the other side now,
sure.
That we assume that anybody who isn't married must be some sort of least strange person.
Yeah.
That's a strange phenomenon. We have a mental set about putting heterosexuals and marriage in one basket and non-married in another basket.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that
sure.
I don't know where we've gotten that, but there seems to be a strange direction.
Viewing sexuality as procreative, essentially, as most of the church has most of its history, that certainly has produced a lot of it, and so that the goal is procreation, the goal is family, only within family, and so if you really are God's people, you are procreating in a family. That seems to be pretty logical out of where we've been. But as you say, that's not demanded. It isn't, you aren't God-fearing if you don't have a child or if you don't get married. We don't preach that, but we certainly... demonstrate that in many places. Parishes that suddenly discover, I was with one not too long ago, discovered they were so family-oriented, everything around the family, children, services, they were really fabulous, and then found out that 30% of their congregation were single adults and began doing some other things in addition to the family.
I'm wondering how many of us chose to be, I don't want to make any assumptions that everybody here is heterosexual and homosexual, but
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how many of us chose to be heterosexual. I never did. And I'm wondering, hey, if I was going through the struggle of being, thinking that I am a homosexual, how, I'd have to go through that struggle. Why am I homosexual?
Mm-hmm.
And why are people homosexual? Why are they heterosexual? I never made a choice. And I don't think the homosexual has a... I can't see, when they say they don't have a choice, I can understand that. I can understand the feeling. But, on the other hand, I don't know if there's some kind of thing that's in your head that they turn one way or the other, and you have to turn out one way or the other, or what. I mean, that's also a question that you deal with if you're talking about homosexual. How do you become homosexual?
Yes.
Why do we... hear so much more about homosexuality now? Is it fashionable?
Anyone? What do you think?
I thought that the discrimination of people losing jobs in this society, you know, I thought that people were trying to say, hey, we've got rights too. I think it's an outgrowth of the civil rights movement. Saying we've been oppressed long enough and we have rights when we're people, I think that's an outgrowth of that.
And so then they're acknowledging that they're homosexual. They're not afraid to come out of the closet and say that they are.
I think wanting to be free.
How much does this affect other people that may be on the borderline of being hetero or homosexual? You know what I'm leading to? In other words, now that we have more acceptance of the homosexual, we're struggling with this. Is this helping that person decide to be a homosexual?
I don't think.
Why do we hear so much about homosexuals and the percentage rising?
I haven't heard the percentage rising. Maybe you have.
I read something somewhere recently. I don't remember where it was, but that there was a correlation here, or a possible correlation.
Most of the stuff that I've read over a period of number of years now, the studies that I've seen would not support that, but that doesn't mean somebody else isn't saying it.
Mm-hmm. Is there any statistics on how many homosexuals choose to be homosexual?
No statistics.
I guess my question is, if they choose not to be, are they able to receive help, or do they want help? I guess I haven't heard that brought up at all.
There's a whole range of response to that, whether that help is psychiatric, medical, in terms of social setting or whatever else it may be. The research, again, differs as to the amount of help that can be given. You recall that the American Psychiatric Association said more recently, and still with not with a majority, but not certainly unanimously, that it can be healthy to be homosexual, and therefore it assumes that you could help somebody to help within it, or if someone would choose not to be. But there's other research that indicates all the kind of help that's given for someone who is homosexually oriented. If you mean help means changing them, the research indicates you can't. One of the complex things about the whole issue that I think we've underscored a number of times tonight, from the point of physiological, psychological, sociological, is the great complexity to it, and that we really haven't much of that information in. For me, that underscores that. Because I think your question, is an important one. It could be studied, and I know that it is, just from what I read about being studied, but I do not have reports on it.
Can I ask a question of people that know more about the history of the Lutheran Church? What is the attitude, traditional attitude, towards practicing adulterers of the Lutheran Church? So practicing public adulterers, it seems to me to be a good parallel to practicing public homosexuals. What happens to them?
What?
Do they become bishops? Do they get thrown out?
You're saying for you that would be a parallel?
Yes.
Okay. Just want to be careful. Someone want to respond?
Well, they're admonished, and if they don't repent, change of behavior, they've finally been excluded.
So
as a warning, is a warning that, well, a warning that their behavior is inappropriate and that it's they're in danger if they continue it. And finally, they've removed themselves from fellowship is what excommunication is.
But that's still based on the assumption that homosexuality is a sin, in parallel with adultery.
Well, it seems to me to be as clear as any ethical norm in the Bible. Certainly as clear as adultery or fornication.
No. It seems to you. He said that.
Yeah,
that's legitimate for him to say that.
Adultery is breaking into a relationship between two people that's already established.
Well, okay, fornication.
Or the two people.
Maybe that's closer. Okay, parallel to fornication. That's close. In that sense, because it's not breaking an existing relationship.
It's a little harder. That's like the drunk who goes to confessionary Saturday night and repents. You know, when does the priest finally, for his own welfare, say, well, I don't accept your repentance this time? That's a very difficult question. And I don't know if the church is honest in dealing with it, what the answer would be. I think the church has usually let the drunk go to Mass the next day, even though experience tells them it's not going to change behavior.
We have even trouble with divorce in terms of our pastors. We have difficulties getting calls. I know of a person who is still not able to get a call. He's remarried, has a marvelous family, but because he was divorced, he's ostracized. I think we even have problems there, much less adultery and homosexuality. We have a long way to go in terms of forgiving people who make mistakes.
You know, one thing that helped a bunch of us who were thinking through the issue a while back was to look at the main themes of the gospel, not isolated passages, and to try to envision there what things are said that can be taken to be supportive of a more open and accepting stance toward homosexuality. And we discovered things like Paul's emphasis on the need for diversity within the body of Christ, that is being a positive feature of what it means to be part of community. Suspicion, and this is suspicion about the way in which family ties themselves can become bonds of inhibition from accepting wholeheartedly the kingdom, which to us raises real questions about a movement like Save Our Children that focuses on the threat to the family that homosexuality supposedly raises. Really asking that basic question, how Christian is it to be concerned with the family to an extent that can become almost an idolatrous concern. The kinds of legalistic, nitpicking kinds of behavior that the traditional opponents of Jesus, the Pharisees, had as their characteristic behavior. To look at the main outlines of the gospel story to see where this issue fits in, the ways in which it isn't addressed directly.
I'm a little upset so much of the discussion is centered around whether or not homosexuality is wrong or right or a sin or not a sin, et cetera, et cetera. That goes for the divorce, for premarital sexual relations, etc. I would just like to see the conversation more centered on the truth of responsibility.
But when you say makes things nice, that's pejorative, that there wouldn't be any people in the room who really have convictions that those may be evil. I would hope that you would allow for that.
I'm sorry, but I didn't hear you.
Well, when you said that we were concerned about things that make things nice, it seemed to me it's a pejorative way of saying that, because there may be people who truly believe that those that are evil and that of their relationship to God in Christ have been led to that. I would want to allow at least for that discussion to take place, and allow it for yours too.